Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. For decades, there were rumors and complaints about Dr. Stanley Patrick Weber's odd behavior with the young boys in his care. He was a pediatrician with the Indian Health Service, but instead of being thoroughly investigated, Dr. Stanley Patrick Weber was simply moved from one reservation to the next. The allegations continued to surface and then just get brushed aside. And then, just this past September, Stanley Patrick Weber was convicted of sexually molesting two boys. And in January, the 70-year-old Weber was sentenced to 18 years in prison. Weber is appealing the verdict, but a new Wall Street Journal PBS Frontline investigation shows that for decades, warnings about this man's behavior went unheeded. And apparently Weber is far from the only doctor with a questionable history employed at reservation hospitals. The documentary entitled Predator on the Reservation airs today, Tuesday, February 12th at 10/9 Central on PBS. A print version of the investigation appeared in the Wall Street Journal February 8th. You can find links to that article at yourcallradio.org. Here today to join us and explain some of these revelations, we're joined by Dan Frosch. He's a general assignment reporter for the Wall Street Journal's Southwest Bureau. Dan is based in Denver, and he covers Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming, and he frequently writes about Native American issues. Dan, thanks for joining us from New York today. So glad you could be with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the fact that more and more it is so rare to find publications and outlets, news outlets, willing to invest the kind of time and money that it takes to really thoroughly investigate something like this. It took you 2 years, so congratulations to the Wall Street Journal for committing the time and the resources, and congratulations to you and your colleague for just a remarkable story. Really well done.
I appreciate it. We felt like this was a story that needed considerable resources and attention and was worth telling.
It goes back to the 80s. What got you onto this story in the first place?
Well, even before this particular story, my colleague Chris Weaver and I had been focusing on the Indian Health Service and the history of systemic failures that hospitals, government-run hospitals on Indian reservations have had, regulatory failings, putting patients in jeopardy. And during the course of our reporting on that particular story, which really started about 3 years ago, we came across the case of Dr. Stanley Patrick Weber, and we were struck by the fact that this was a doctor who had seemingly been accused of sexually assaulting young male patients for years and years and years, and had only finally been indicted and then ultimately convicted after a 20-plus year career at the Indian Health Service. And then when we probed a little bit deeper, we had discovered that he had actually been transferred around the IHS from reservation to reservation, as you pointed out. And that sort of opened the door to this world of troubled doctors who end up at the Indian Health Service, and in particular, the story of Dr. Weber, who is really sort of the most egregious example of the failings of this very large government agency, which has a treaty obligation to treat Native Americans.
In watching the documentary, Dan, it appears that he was hiding in plain sight. He was going from reservation to reservation. People in each one of those places began to see these troubling patterns. He even had a preference for a certain kind of boy. He wanted slim boys who were at high risk, who were poor, who maybe had already been abused. They even came to be known as Weber boys. So how much digging did you have to do? Or was it just a matter of asking obvious questions based on documentation that was readily available to anyone who just cared to look?
Well, you're certainly correct in the fact that there were long There were suspicions about Dr. Weber for a long period of time, and rumors swirling about his treatment of young boys. When he started off his IHS career in Montana on the Blackfeet Reservation, it was very readily apparent that he had kept after-hours clinics where he would treat young boys, and there was sort of a cadre of young boys who would be hanging out at his house. And then when he was moved to the Pine Ridge Reservation after it got too hot for him in Montana, Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, that is, those same suspicions and rumors followed him. But there were never any specific and concrete allegations that that were really thoroughly investigated by the authorities throughout this time period. And so, you know, while there was plenty of innuendo about Dr. Weber, it really did take some sort of digging on our part to get a sense of who precisely was looking into these allegations, what was being done about them, and trying to find out who his victims were. Not a lot of folks initially wanted to speak with us, so it really took months, and in some cases, really, nearly a year to earn the trust of folks to get them to sort of open up and share what they remembered and what they knew.
You start out in about 1986, or he started in 86 to 89 in Oklahoma, and then you go to 1992. That's when he goes to the Browning, Montana Blackfeet Reservation. And as you just said, there were some clues and there were some rumors and there were some kind of nebulous things that maybe were proof and maybe not. Things like he had sort of a trailer, and the boys would come, and only boys would come to his trailer or into his home, and one of the tribal leaders, whose job it was to inspect some of the dwellings there, just went in his basement and just found stacks and stacks of things that kids would enjoy, kids' games, snacks, things like that. And in the documentary, he points out, this seemed strange, but is that what you kept running into, suspicion without proof?
Well, I think just sort of putting this in a larger context, starting with Montana, this was a reservation that is really sort of at the end of the earth. It butts up against Canada. It's very difficult to get to. So it's exceedingly difficult to get doctors to go out there and work. And so the Indian Health Service officials who had hired Dr. Weber had been without a pediatrician for some time. And so here was this guy who comes out there, and they are excited that there's finally a doctor who, you know, is seemingly engaged with the community, wants to treat sort of young, troubled kids. That, in effect, blinded them to these very obvious sort of suspicions and clues about his behavior, which a former IHS psychologist who worked with Dr. Weber at the time characterized as sort of very obvious grooming behavior. And it was really because of this sort of dire need for doctors in these far-flung, desolate places that folks in charge could not see what, in effect, he was doing, even though, as you point out, it was very obvious. And so that's really what happened in Montana. This was a guy who came out to the reservation, immediately, you know, launched himself into various community programs, had sort of this Pied Piper quiet charisma aspect about him. So when these suspicions were brought to the attention of IHS supervisors, when this tribal counselor, who was then a maintenance worker who you referred to, found these stacks of games and toys in the doctor's basement, a really sort of an unsettling discovery on his part. The IHS official who he reported to said, "Well, you know, that's not enough for us to go on. There's really no proof beyond that." And you know, on top of that, when others began to bring forward their suspicions about the doctor, "Well, we've seen him with young boys at his house after hours. We've seen him acting sort of inappropriately with kids, too friendly." They were met with sort of the same sort of benign denial, I guess, if one could call it that. In other words, the officials did not have any sort of allegations or proof that he had done anything wrong beyond these suspicions. And in their mind, here was a guy who had come out here to Montana to this poor reservation and was willing to get his hands dirty. And they overlooked these concerns that really sort of started to cascade the longer Dr. Weber stayed in Montana.
Well, it sounds like he certainly profiled his potential victims, but it also sounds, Dan, like maybe he was profiling the very circumstances in which he wanted to work. The IHS provides medical care for nearly 2.5 million Native Americans who mostly have no other access to health care. So they were desperate for health care. They were in extremely isolated circumstances. Do you think he sought out these very circumstances?
Certainly. The IHS, through the course of our reporting, it became very clear to us that this was a place where doctors who had run into trouble in other places and maybe could not necessarily be hired in more sort of traditional medical settings, this was a place for them to hide. Nobody was paying attention. The Indian Health Service, as I mentioned, was sort of desperate for doctors and medical staff. And Dr. Weber certainly was able to seek out places where he could really sort of escape the sort of notice that he would have attracted had he been in a much more populated setting. And he benefited from that and took advantage of it and exploited it. And on top of that, he had access to young, troubled boys from broken homes who he was charged with treating. And so it really was sort of a perfect environment for somebody like Dr. Weber to settle in and begin grooming young men, or boys, I should say. We found during our reporting that he was not the only one who was able to sort of seek out these remote, isolated locations and engage in similarly deviant behavior.
Did you actually get to interview him at all?
We did not. We tried to speak with him at various court hearings, and he rebuffed us and then eventually rebuffed us through his lawyers. We were able to obtain a very lengthy interview that federal investigators did with him during their investigation, an audio interview, which appears in the film. And it's really quite fascinating. And they sort of take you through sort of his career and ask him pointed questions. So you do hear his voice hauntingly, I should add, throughout the course of the film.
Exactly. I thought that was really chilling to hear his voice in the documentary. You didn't get to see him, and he's 70 years old now, but you do have photographs of him, and he's, he looks like a little nerdy guy with Coke bottle glasses,
right.
Very avuncular,
right.
Very non-threatening. Mm-hmm. Not that there's any such thing as a real what does a pedophile look like, but you can kind of see where people would not think he's very small in stature, so there would not necessarily be a look that he had that made him look like the predator that he turned out to be. So when did things actually start to unravel? Was Paul, the man that you only identify as Paul, was he the first one who started to sound the alarm with officials?
Well, there were numerous people who were sounding the alarm with officials, which I think was sort of the most disturbing part of our investigation, right? You know, when he was in Montana, sort of towards the end of his time in Montana, his 3-year tenure there, a parent made a complaint that Dr. Weber was having their kid sleep over at his house. And somebody assaulted Dr. Weber. And the suspicions were that it was a parent who was upset with the inordinate amount of time that Dr. Weber was spending with their kid. At that point, the IHS officials in Browning had enough. And despite the fact that they had largely been pleased with this doctor who took an interest in their community, they knew they needed to get rid of him. They thought maybe he was a pedophile, and they passed him along to higher-up IHS officials who, instead of firing him, transferred him to Pine Ridge, South Dakota, another poor, isolated reservation in desperate need of medical staff. And it was there that he functioned and flourished for 2 more decades. During that time, there were numerous complaints almost immediately upon him getting there, complaints about how he treated boys. Still, nothing was done about him. Those complaints were sort of brushed aside for many of the same reasons we suspect that they were initially ignored in Browning. But there was an incident that happened that finally prompted some investigators outside of the IHS to take action. And this was an incident that occurred sort of later on in Dr. Weber's tenure in Pine Ridge, where he was assaulted by several Native young men and decided not to press charges. He was beaten fairly badly. And that struck tribal investigators as odd. Why would this federal doctor who was beaten badly not press charges against several young men who beat him up? And it turned out that one of the young men who was involved in this assault was a young man by the name of Paul. We identify him as Paul in our film. He did not want us to use his last name, and he was a victim of Dr. Weber's. And tribal investigators eventually uncovered this, and they finally had a name and a victim that they could go on, and that sort of launched a much more rigorous investigation into what he had been doing, and really started to unravel his time at the Indian Health Service.
And when you once this began to unravel and you began to pull on the threads, what were the behaviors that seemed to be manifesting themselves everywhere this Dr. Weber stopped? What was his MO? What was he doing?
Well, he took almost an exclusive interest in young boys, right? He's a pediatrician, so there's nothing that says he shouldn't be treating young girls as well. But fellow medical staff noticed that Dr. Weber only was treating young boys, which they found odd and suspicious. He at one point was cherry picking young teenage boys from troubled homes to treat. And
he went through one doctor's file and literally just went through and chose those kinds of little boys, right?
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And he also, both in Montana and Pine Ridge, would keep after-hours clinics where he would be, again, treating young boys, only young boys. And then young boys would be seen at his home, his government homes, both in Montana and Pine Ridge. And he would sort of use the excuse when confronted about it that they would, you know, they would be mowing his lawn or doing house chores for him. So it was this really sort of intense grooming behavior. And for poor kids on the reservation coming from broken homes, here was a guy who had money. He would buy them things. He would take them places to basketball games, camping. These were kids who did not have stable family structures. They could go hang out at his home. He was at least you know, it appeared that he was being kind to them and cared for them, when in fact clearly he had ulterior motives. But this sort of behavior, so obvious to folks who were not there, just was really ignored or denied by his supervisors for years and years and years. And, you know, unbeknownst to them, he was assaulting, raping, abusing many of these children throughout the course of his tenure at the Indian Health Service.
And no one was actually stepping forward, and those who did were cut off at the knees practically. They were reassigned or themselves. Or themselves were found to be pedophiles, and we'll get into that in a moment. If you're just joining us, Dan Frosch is a general assignment reporter for the Wall Street Journal Southwest Bureau. He's based in Denver, and today we're talking about the Wall Street Journal PBS Frontline investigation called Predator on the Reservation. It's the story of a doctor who went for 30 years from one reservation to another, to another, to another, victimizing young boys. And it turns out he may not be an outlier. It may turn out that this is a lot more common than we know. 866-798-8255 is the number if you have questions for Dan Frosch. That documentary airs tonight at 9 on PBS. Dan, what happened to people who came forward and expressed their concerns or suspicions?
Well, to put it bluntly, they were met with denial, rejection, and in some cases, punishment. Throughout the course of Dr. Weber's career, almost from the beginning, there were other doctors who raised red flags about him. They went to supervisors. They went to the FBI. They went to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They said, hey, there's something about this guy that does not seem right. Can you look into him, please?
Mm-hmm.
Those investigations either went nowhere or never actually sort of happened at all. In one case, a doctor who's featured prominently in our film was actually punished for continuing to raise the alarm about Dr. Weber. He was stripped of his bonus pay and transferred to an even more remote sort of reservation before having his pay reinstated. And it was enormously frustrating for these doctors who were sure that Native boys were being assaulted and abused by this doctor and could get nowhere. And it was deeply troubling and upsetting. They knew some of the patients that Dr. Weber was seeing, but here was a guy who had so sort of skillfully embedded himself in these communities and endeared himself to officials, families, children, that there was no way that he was going to be punished and disciplined simply because doctors were raising complaints about him without any specific allegation of abuse.
The retribution that you described was against Dr. Mark Butterbrodt, is that right?
That's correct, mm-hmm. Yes.
And he was the one who said that, look, this guy is actually going through my case files, my patient files, and he is picking my patients that match his preferences. And when this man comes forward, they send him out to the equivalent of Siberia. They send mm-hmm. him to the most far-flung reaches. So how did a system that was so sluggish to respond to serious repeated allegations against Weber manage to respond so quickly and decisively to punish Butterbrodt after just one angry outburst? Because I think Butterbrodt came at him, right? He said, if I could, I would, you know, do him harm, except his terms were a lot more graphic. So why did they mobilize against Butterbrodt and look the other way with Weber?
You raise a great point, and it's one of the tragic paradoxes of this story, that the doctors who came forward and spoke out about this pediatrician were essentially banished and their views shunned. And, you know, it's something that we wrestled with during the course of our reporting. You know, why was Dr. Weber allowed to continue treating children for so many years when there were so many complaints about him, when really in any sort of other medical setting he likely would have been disciplined, punished, and more thoroughly investigated? And, you know, some of it goes to the circumstances out of which he was operating, again, in these places where it was very, very difficult to find pediatricians who were willing to come out there and work for less pay than they would work, for example, at the VA or in some big city general hospital. And there, you know, another thing that we found was that doctors on the reservation were really sort of revered and treated as healers to a certain extent. And in, you know, even in the mindset of IHS officials on the reservation, many of whom were tribal members themselves, there was a denial that a doctor, somebody who would come out there to help, could be so such a monster. On the contrary, he was somebody who was willing to take on their most troubled kids. So anybody who complains about him, you know, you've got a problem. So as I said, it was really just an awful irony that it wasn't as if this guy sort of went completely unnoticed and then suddenly 25 years later it turns out he was living this double life. It was very clear to very, very many people that he was indeed, you know, grooming, abusing, exploiting kids. But the politics and the sort of ingrained feeling and sentiment that the doctors were incredibly important people on the reservation who you know, could do no wrong, allowed him to escape any sort of real discipline and punishment until it was too late.
That's Dan Frosch, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and a collaborator in the documentary airing tonight on PBS called Predator on the Reservation. How did non-tribal law enforcement respond to this predator? And what other ways are perhaps Native American reservation communities vulnerable to these predators? We'll ask Dan those questions when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today on Your Call, and we're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there, sign up for our newsletter, and find out what's coming up next. And speaking of coming up next, tomorrow on Your Call, we're talking about the resources available to Americans who are facing housing and money and food shortages. That latest government 35-day shutdown certainly showed people who were furloughed going to food banks for help. But it's not just furloughed workers who need help. 4 out of 10 Americans are just $400, one paycheck away, rather, from a disaster. And 40% of Americans can't even afford an unexpected $400 expense. So what did that shutdown teach us about the need in the communities, silent needs, and what services are perhaps available? That's on the next Your Call. Today, we're talking about a predatory doctor on a Native American reservation. He was able to practice for decades before facing any repercussions for this sexual misconduct against the boys in his care. How did he get away with it? Are there others? And what's happening on Native American reservations that make them ripe for this kind of predator? 866-798-8255 is the number, and we're talking with Dan Frosch, General Assignment Reporter for the Wall Street Journal. So, Dan, talk about how the noose began to tighten and how law enforcement began to close in on him, and to what extent was there a jurisdictional problem that kind of slowed this whole process down in terms of getting to him. The fact that tribal police have no jurisdiction over non-Indians clearly was an impediment, right?
Yeah, I mean, jurisdictional issues are always a problem when it comes to enforcing crime on reservations. So that is not necessarily a specific concern as it with this case alone. It's often sort of a tangle between the FBI, the BIA, and local tribal law enforcement when it comes to policing and prosecuting violent crime on Indian reservations. And this was really sort of a glaring example of that, where you had sort of the FBI really sort of unable to sort of corroborate any of the allegations made against Dr. Weber over the years. And it took a tribal prosecutor on Pine Ridge, a woman by the name of Elaine Yellowhorse, who through a source of hers was given Paul's name, Paul being one of the men who beat up Dr. Weber, and Dr. Weber did not press charges against, and she was able to track him down. He was incarcerated in the state penitentiary, and she was finally able to sort of get him to speak with her about what he had experienced at the hands of Dr. Weber. He had been raped and assaulted and abused over a course of many years. And that was sort of what started this this cascade of allegations that were connected to actual victims and individuals. And from there, the tribal investigator and the attorney general for the Pine Ridge Reservation, Tatewin Means, were able to locate other victims. And they, you know, this was all sort of then referred to the Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General, you know, agents with that particular division began looking into Dr. Weber and really sort of zeroed in on him, focusing on not only his time in Pine Ridge, but his time in Browning, Montana, and were able to find numerous victims in both places.
And when you spoke to Elaine Yellowhorse, there was Paul and then one other, at least one other, who ended up being part of the case against Dr. Weber. How hard was it to get people to start coming forward, not just victims, but the people who had to eventually admit, yes, I saw something. Yes, I should have known. Yes, I should have acted. The documentary, I thought, was really poignant in that there were some people who said, I wanted to keep my job. You know, how right. hard was it once the floodgates right. opened to get people to start actually talking about what they had known for years?
It was really difficult. I've been a reporter for 20 years, and this is the most challenging story I've ever worked on. Namely because, for several reasons, I should say. Number one, you're asking folks to recount incidents, events, decisions that they made 20 years in the past that they may be purposefully repressing or don't want to think about. And I'm speaking about the IHS officials, former IHS officials, former tribal leaders who sort of overlooked the very clear signs about Dr. Weber's behavior. And even when they can remember them and are cognizant of them, they don't want to talk about them. They don't want to sort of acknowledge their role in letting this guy abuse their boys, the boys in these communities. And so it was really, really challenging to get folks to sort of describe the decisions they made, people in leadership. Why did you not pay more attention when this complaint was brought to you? But once you really sort of started spending some time with them and peeling back the layers, you either got a sort of steadfast and very honest assessment, as you mentioned before, from one tribal official who said, if I had been more aggressive about raising these concerns, I would have lost my job, and I couldn't do that. And then you get others who have been haunted by their lack of response and feel guilty and worry. You know, one tribal IHS official who headed up the hospital in Browning, Mary Ellen LaFromboise, who's featured prominently in the film, I think is, you know, a very articulate, reflective woman who cared very deeply about children on the reservation and the public health care that she was providing. And she's been haunted by her role in letting Dr. Weber, sort of waltz on through unscathed on her watch, and is imagines some young man coming up to her at some point asking her why she didn't protect him. And it's a very emotional, hard thing for these folks who are in supervisory positions to discuss. I mean, many of them just refused to call us back. But the ones that we did locate and talk to, it took a very long time for them to agree to speak with us, in some cases over a year.
And they were so emotional. The one that you describe was choked up when she just expressed her regrets. Paul, one of the two men who actually ended up being part of the prosecution, Paul's mother was overcome. How could I not have not seen? How did I let this happen to my son? And even the man who's now in charge of the IHS is overwhelmed because now he lives on that reservation and he says, my family and I now use the Indian Health Service. And he just begins to weep at the very thought of the kind of vulnerability that you have when you walk in hoping to be treated and taken care of and instead become a victim. It's really an outstanding documentary. It's called Predator on the Reservation. 866-798-8255. Do you have an experience with the Indian Health Service? What has been your experience? And if you're in healthcare or law enforcement, do you know of any systems that could maybe serve as models to help identify and root out predatory physicians? Dan Frosch is with us. But Dan, these are such isolated enclaves. Does that make them even more ripe? I thought it was really amazing that one of the men who investigated Dr. Weber was himself charged with possession of child pornography. So just how is this isolated, or does this happen more than we even want to think on reservations?
Yeah, unfortunately, it happens more than obviously it should. And, you know, we found numerous instances of doctors who had either lost their licenses in other places or run afoul of medical boards and even gotten in trouble at the Indian Health Service, but were hired and kept on anyway. As you mentioned, the man the IHS sent to investigate Dr. Weber was subsequently himself arrested for possession of large amounts of child pornography and served prison time. There was doctors that have been hired who have assaulted people in their past, solicited underage prostitutes, really just sort of a terrifying these are almost the dregs of the medical profession to a certain extent. Now, there are plenty of tremendous doctors and medical staff who work at the Indian Health Service, right? This is, you know, they're people who really believe deeply in its mission. But there are too many instances that we found where particular hospitals, regions under the Indian Health Service's purview are too loose in their hiring and credentialing, and are willing to sort of overlook past discrepancies. In some cases, you know, as one IHS supervisor told us, hold their breath and hope that whatever trouble a particular doctor got into before won't come back and bite them when they hire somebody. So it's a widespread problem, and as we know, you know, with a myriad of issues that affect Indian country and reservations, too often these are places and folks whose problems and issues are forgotten and ignored and overlooked. And that is certainly the case with medical care, which, as I mentioned earlier, is really a treaty obligation. The federal government is treaty bound to provide medical care to Native Americans. And so, it's more than just simply a byproduct of these places being isolated. It's actually sort of a legal issue as well.
So starting in about 2015, things began to come to a head with Dr. Stanley Patrick Weber. And in September of 2018, he began to stand trial. He pled not guilty. And in fact, like you said, it was almost kind of bone chilling to hear that dismissive voice, that disembodied voice, because you never see him. You include several, you know, photographs of him, including walking into court, looking very casual, talking about the great weather. He's very dismissive, and of course he pleads not guilty. But describe what happened at trial, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the most sort of powerful moments in this whole story, and hopefully it's conveyed in the film, is the trial in Montana, where you have a parade of boys that Dr. Weber abused who are now young men. And most, if not all of them, have served time in prison. Their lives have become broken since their time with Dr. Weber. And they've turned into, you know, hardened, tough characters. And they look the part, you know, prison tattoos, prison muscles.
Paul has a tattoo on his face, on his mouth, that says vicious, right?
Right. That's actually Joe Fourhorns who has that.
Okay, that's the other
correct
victim.
Okay. And he testified. And so these aren't choir boys. But once they got on the stand and began talking in really sort of painstaking, painful fashion about what Dr. Weber did to them, they sort of transformed back into these little boys, right? And it was this really powerful, sad moment that, you know, one could really sort of see where their lives were now and where their lives had started off and what this guy had done to them. And so it was a very sort of upsetting and moving part of the story that these guys, you know, really heroes to a certain extent, came forward and talked about one of the most humiliating, you know, shameful and awful things that had ever happened to them. It was really difficult in seeing that sort of unfold. It was difficult to see how the jury was not going to convict Dr. Weber.
And in fact, they did. I thought it, you really did a good job on the documentary of juxtaposing these hardened men who are now in their 30s, who are covered mm-hmm. in prison tats. And mm-hmm. like I said, it was Joe Fourhorns, you said, who had mm-hmm. the tattoo mm-hmm. that says vicious on his mouth, mm-hmm. on his face. And, you mm-hmm. know, but you showed pictures of them as just young boys with sweet little faces. It was really remarkable to remind people, and I'm sure that the prosecutors reminded the jury of who these men used to be and the, mm-hmm. the depth of depravity that it took to ruin these boys' lives and hold mm-hmm. Dr. Weber accountable. So he was found guilty. He's appealing now. Mm-hmm. But later this year, he's going on trial in North Dakota, right?
South Dakota, that's right.
Okay, so what are those charges entail?
Same charges, more victims. He spent a longer period of time, you know, considerably longer in South Dakota, 20 years, while he was only in Montana for 3 years. So there are more victims there. And it'll be interesting if he takes a plea or if he tries to go to trial. Given that he's appealing his verdict in Montana, it seems likely that the trial will proceed. Because he was on Pine Ridge for a far longer time, the cases are more recent, they're more graphic, there are many more of them, and you can expect prosecutors to bring, as they did in Montana, a long line of victims who will testify about what Dr. Weber did to them.
Should others be facing charges, in your opinion, Dan? I mean, people who should have responded. Should not there be mandatory reporting? Was there no mandatory reporting in place?
I certainly can't speak to whether anyone should face charges as a result of this, but I do know that that's a question that other investigators have raised. They raised that in the film. It's sort of hard to fathom, why more was not done when his discretions were reported. And the Indian Health Service, since our story and reporting has emerged, have taken some steps to codify their reporting requirements for doctors. And they put out the Admiral Michael Wiaki, who is the featured in the film and runs the Indian Health Service, put out a video message recently to tribal leaders saying that, you know, this was an incredibly important issue for him and he, you know, wanted people to come forward when they had any concerns. It's a bit incredulous to think that this was not something that was happening before, but it clearly was not.
I thought it was interesting, too. I think it was in 2011 that there's a former hospital CEO who had received a complaint about Weber's conduct and did nothing about it. And later it was revealed that this hospital CEO took an undisclosed gift of $5,000, a donation. You don't see me, but I'm making air quotes, a $5,000 donation from mm-hmm. Weber. Did your mm-hmm. investigation uncover any incidents of flat-out bribery or corruption that protected Weber or others like him for all of those years?
Well, the example that you raised is certainly the most blatant of those, where the CEO of the Pine Ridge Hospital at the time, Winona Stabler, who really had sort of an untarnished and very good reputation up until that point, had received an anonymous complaint about Dr. Weber, and she did not sort of follow up on it. Her explanation was that it was anonymous and she couldn't really sort of verify anything. And then subsequent to that, took a $5,000 gift from Dr. Weber, and she was indicted by the U.S. Attorney's Office and ended up pleading guilty to failing to report that gift as a federal employee, and was sentenced to probation. So there, you know, that was sort of the most blatant example. There were other less obvious and you know,
because that was pretty obvious, sort of,
right? Yeah. And dare I say more insidious examples? Mm-hmm. The one we spoke about earlier, where you have Dr. Mark Butterbrodt, who does everything in his power, is shouting from the rooftops that this guy's a pedophile, and is just transferred and has his bonus pay taken away for his for coming forward.
What's his status right now?
So Dr. Butterbrodt has been very involved in sort of keeping an eye on the investigation. He was you know, hugely important to our story, and he was actually called to testify in the Montana case, but ultimately never ended up testifying. I think the prosecution sort of decided against calling him because they felt like the victims themselves, who they called, sort of spoke more directly to what had happened to them. But you know, we could not have sort of done this story without Dr. Butterbrodt and another psychologist, Indian Health Service psychologist by the name of Dan Foster and his wife Becky Foster, who were similarly sounding the alarms about Dr. Weber. And this is sort of, I think, seeing Dr. Weber finally be punished for his crimes has brought sort of a painful resolution to them at some level, but also just a feeling of great sadness on their part that, you know, all their years spent raising concerns about him had done nothing to prevent boys from being molested.
And what about going forward? Have you found any instances at all, even now going forward, of any Indian Health Service doctors being fired or disciplined? And if so, what distinguished those cases that made them actionable?
Well, we're continuing to look into this. That's kind of all I'll say at the moment about that. We found many examples of doctors who, as I mentioned earlier, had sort of run afoul of the law, were hired by the Indian Health Service, and escaped any sort of disciplinary action despite very obvious transgressions. So, you know, this is an issue that we've been writing about now for 3 years, and this film is sort of the latest chapter, I should say, in our coverage of this, and it's something we've, you know, worked very hard to sort of call attention to, we really hope that the film sort of conveys this horrifying story in a way that's, not only brings sort of home what these young people on the reservations have gone through at the hands of this doctor, but also perhaps maybe all. You know, maybe naively compels more attention to these places, perhaps change, reforms, and so forth.
Is he? Is Dr. Weber currently behind bars? Is he?
He is. Yeah, he's okay. Behind bars. Yep.
Okay. And you mentioned Rear Admiral Michael Wiaki, and he's
Wiaki.
Now Wiaki. Mm-hmm. Okay. He's acting head of the Indian Health Service now, and mm-hmm. he has promised, tearfully I might add, he has been really personally moved by these circumstances. He promised an investigation into Weber and how he was able to prey on children under the agency's care. Do you know the status of that promised investigation?
We don't. I mean, we're going to be following up on it. I mean, it just started, I should say, the investigation. So we're going to be watching that closely. you know, this is it's not a new issue for them, and I think that's part of the problem. That, you know, as far back as 2010 and even before that, congressional committees were looking into the Indian Health Service's practice of hiring troubled doctors, and had really sort of criticized the IHS for doing so. Clearly, those congressional probes and that public attention did not do much, if anything. And so, you know, it remains to be seen, I should say, whether Admiral Baiocchi's promise will really amount to any sort of significant change.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dan Frosch. He's a general assignment reporter for the Wall Street Journal Southwest Bureau, and he is one of the reporters who worked on the documentary entitled Predator on the Reservation. It airs tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock, and you can link to the Wall Street Journal article at yourcallradio.org. Dan Frosch, thank you so much for the hard work that I know it takes to do this kind of in-depth reporting, and thanks for the follow-up and your conversation today.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review, follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio, and email us show ideas. We love that. And to hear feedback, and you can send that to yourcall@kalw.org. Laura Winnes produced today's show. Joshua Wilner is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is in the studio as our engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's Your Call.